G'day coaches. Well, it's out. Evolve Rugby, an online coach development course based on 100 plus interviews from this very podcast. Are you a club coach looking to continually develop? Do you want to increase numbers to training, be more adaptable, be able to coach to a variety of skill levels, and save time? Then check out the link in the show notes for a sneak peek of the Evolve Rugby online coach development course. Also, sign up to the newsletter so you can receive the latest offers. Feel free to reach out to me if you have any questions, but for now, kick back and enjoy the episode.
You're listening to the Rugby Coaches Corner podcast with your host, Andy Plimer. Bringing you up-to-date coaching concepts from the world of rugby. Sharing ideas to make the game better.
Welcome to episode 110 of the Rugby Coaches Corner podcast. I'm your host, Andy Plimer, and joining me today is Cody Royal. Cody is the former head coach of AFL Canada and now focuses on developing elite head coaches. He's the author of two books, with his most recent one titled The Tough Stuff, Seven Hard Truths About Being a Head Coach. He's an Aussie based in Canada, and it's a pleasure to have him on the show. So welcome, Cody.
G'day, Andy. I'm disappointed you're not taking video, actually, because I've got my headboard on the bed behind me. I know Rusty likes to record podcasts on his bed, so... My idea was to try to challenge him with my headboard, but delighted to be here, mate. And it's funny that I'm from Toronto, you're from Montreal, and I'm talking to you from Ireland now.
Yeah, we're going the long way around it, but if you're trying to emulate Rusty, you've got a shirt on, so you're already you're already losing. He'd be shirtless for sure, and he'd be flatter as well, and you'd be able to see up the nose.
True, that's true.
Cool. So, you're in Toronto. You're Aussie originally. What's a bit of a backstory about your playing sport, childhood, coming through to Aussie rules and those kind of things?
Yeah, I was born in Canberra. Rugby league was actually my first sport. Many people forget that pre Brumbies there was only the Raiders.
Yeah,
and so I was Mal Meninga, Green Milk. Era Canberra Raiders, and so there was nothing else to focus on as a child. And we moved to Melbourne when I was eight, and that's when I kind of ended up taking the Aussie rules path. And again, people forget this, pre-Rebels. There used to be no pre-Storm, pre-Rebels. There was no such thing as the rugby codes down in Victoria. So even if I wanted to play league when we moved to Melbourne, that wasn't going to be an option.
Yeah.
So it ended up in Aussie rules and played in the elite pathways. I played for Victoria at age group level and then didn't get drafted and ended up in coaching at 23, which is young for us. I think most people tend to go back to suburban level and, you know, get their $500,000 a game until they're 38 and then start coaching. Whereas I got in at 23, 25, moved to Canada, and the idea was to go back and to try to get into the AFL coaching pathway, but never went home, as you and I were talking about before. Yeah. Never went home and been in Toronto for the last 13 years. Now married a lovely Irish woman. We just had our first son. And as you mentioned before, most of my coaching has been with the national program in Canada. So I was fairly non-existent when me and my predecessor joined, and we built it into something which we think replicates high performance on a minimal budget. And so, yeah, the process of writing about that and blogging and the books and podcast has really kind of led me to where I am now. I was pretty open about my journey, and part of the writing and the podcasting was my own learning, because frankly, trying to learn as a Aussie rules coach in Canada was very hard. There weren't Zoom calls that you could do with AFL coaches. The AFL doesn't care about international Aussie rules. And so trying to find resources to continually improve was difficult. And so I just created my own.
Mm.
And so that's kind of led me on to this journey here with, you know, writing the tough stuff and then ending up, coaching coaches.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. I think there's a lot of similarities to coaching rugby in a country like Canada and coaching Aussie rules. Aussie rules probably a lot more foreign than what rugby would be. Most people recognize that rugby exists at least in Canada, and then they know there's this other game in Australia that's very different. So I think there's a lot of lessons and challenges that would be similar in terms of trying to create an elite pathway. What were some of your, like, reflecting on that role, what were some of the big kind of hurdles that you had to try and get over to create some kind of elite environment for those players?
The mindset is one, and you know, I've had exposure to the rugby mindset as well, and so, you know, I think, and this may be the Australian in me, but just not willing to accept no or anything less than the highest standards and a winning mentality is probably the biggest hurdle. And we worked for over 10 years to try to instill that in AFL Canada. And, you know, I was lucky to have a president who had the same mentality, you know, did the hard yards, allowed and fostered some of the crazy ideas or the things where maybe we were overreaching a little bit, but just said, let's go for it and set big goals, and, you know, fully supported that. And so, you know, there's a piece of alignment there. You need to enroll people in the organization that are on board with that and willing to take risks and willing to dial for dollars and find sponsors and, you know, exchange goods and services and come up with crazy plans to find ways to make it happen. But, you know, I think there's just an unwillingness to accept no and to accept anything less than the standards that tends to hamper a lot of organizations. And we were just lucky to get a bunch of people together at the same time who just refused to accept anything less.
Yeah, I think that's key. Like, and it's probably reflecting on my earlier coaching, especially at the rep level and, age grade national, was just, I struggle with that as well. And I struggle with inertia when I see that there's potential opportunities and there's roadblock after roadblock. And also probably an Aussie trait, I tried to, you know, bash through those roadblocks head first and maybe lost a few comrades along the way there. So I think, it's a struggle when it's not the main sport or even on the front of mind for a lot of people, administrators and public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. There might be a more nuanced approach to it, but, you know, the bulldozing tends to be the cost of wanting to go fast.
Mm, definitely.
And, you know, it's a, hey, if you say that in Silicon Valley and you're a tech company, you get celebrated for doing that. And so, you know, that it is possible when you get the right people together to move fast. And that means some people are going to drop off, but that's the cost of moving fast and having high standards. And so, we just see organizations manage to create this so often. And that was my mentality, is like, other people are doing it, and so why shouldn't we be able to do it?
Yeah, spot on. I agree. And what you're now in a head coach developer role. What was the big move, or the main reason or main reasons that you decided to switch from coaching to actually coaching coaches?
Yeah, I mean, I don't like the term coach developer. I think that gives people the impression that I arrive with a clipboard in a judgmental. You know, your cones are this distance apart, and so you get a big cross on your check sheet. That's not what I do, but
Rusty, so you shouldn't be using cones.
Exactly. And I would agree with him there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm a head coach. I probably, maybe people would call this a mentor, but I just say that I'm a coach and I apply the same methodologies that I use with our players on coaches. So I'm really working on coaching performance. And so what that means is getting your hands dirty really at the level with the coach and being in there with them, working on real world challenges. So not what framework are you using, not the latest research necessarily, but like what are the big rocks that are in front of you right now and how do we find a way for you to navigate past those? And often what that is actually personal development for the coach. And so, you know, it could be storytelling, a line of storytelling. It could be a performance plan for them personally. So how are you preparing yourself? You know, what sort of state do you need to be in for training? What sort of state do you need to be in for meetings? What sort of state do you need to be in for your performance, which is the game? You know, the lines of same kind of things that we use for players. So how you're sleeping, how you're eating, how's your family? Have you seen them? You know, when are you eating? When are you sleeping? What does your day look like? And so, yeah, it's really the coaching performance. And how I got to that, to answer the actual question that you asked, Andy, was I had a player take his own life. Just before we went to our World Cup in 2020, or didn't go to our World Cup in 2020, because of what happened. But that was very confronting for someone who, you know, had 13 years of head coaching experience and thought that he knew everything about coaching and was put into a scenario of helping 50 young men grieve and being looked to try to help them. And yeah, threw me through a loop. And the outcome of that was looking for resources to help with the stuff that's not the X's and O's. And I couldn't find any. And so I decided to write the tough stuff because I was really solving my own problem. I was looking for where's the conversation on the emotional toll? Where's the conversation on the things that are away from the field? And so, yeah, it was a bit of a response to my own challenges and what I needed to see in the world. So I went and created what I needed to see and maybe positively for me, but maybe I also see the negative of this is a lot of coaches have really resonated with what was in that book, which means we're all kind of struggling with the same things at the same time. And so a lot of coaches came to me and said, can you help me with the things that you wrote about?
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I think listening to that as well, it makes me think, well, every sport, it doesn't matter. You don't have to just be working in Aussie rules. Every sport has, every coach in every sport has these challenges and has these pressures and those kind of things. And I also think, yeah, the gaps are there. And it's probably because, I don't know, we as humans, we think in a pretty linear way. And it's like, okay, players look up to the coach. The coach has got all the answers. Coach has got his life in control and, you know, he's nice and balanced and understands, you know, where we're going and things like that. And the truth is, like, we're human beings full of flaws, full of challenges. And I think it's imperative that we have that support, you know, at all levels, not just at the professional level.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's a relatively new discipline as well. If you look at just the professionalization of coaching, really we're only talking about a period largely from about the 90s onwards, even the mid 90s onwards. So there are some sport, you know, basketball and the NFL and things like that, who it's been a little bit more developed, but on the whole globally,
you didn't say hockey.
Well, yeah, no. Maybe
you're Canadian, you have to. That maybe, should have been the first one.
I should have been, yeah.
Sorry,
But you know, so we're dealing with a relatively new discipline still, and it's going through a change that is has resulted from that professionalization. And so what we did was we went, you know, late 80s, I'm still working. So I've got a 9 to 5, and then I go and I coach a professional team, you know, from 5 till 9, and then I go home. And so we had limited time. And so coaching was actually probably better, frankly, because we had limited time. And so we focused on what was important in that time. Then we went to professionalism, where coaching had abundant hours. And so like, oh, look at all these things that I can do now. I can do video analysis. I can sit and I can, and we just added and added and added. And it's become the curse of more. Yeah. We've just tried to add more time doing things, more staff, more video, more analysis, more statistical breakdowns, more training. And what was always going to happen, Andy, was like that you run out of more.
Mm.
It hits a breaking point eventually, and this is that breaking point. We can't add any more.
Mm.
And so something or someone was going to break, and now it's the coaches that are breaking.
Mm.
And so, you know, the part of my role is to really think through with head coaches, like, what do you actually want to do? Like, what is effective?
Mm.
You know, we're not talking about necessarily doing less at the elite levels, but how do we do better?
Yeah.
How do we do coaching better?
Yeah, agree. And we'll talking off air about Andy Friend. He's been a guest of the podcast, and he spoke really well about what you just talked about there. And he's like, you know, even if I work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, I still wouldn't get it all done. So what's the point of trying to do that? Let's find what are the really key components that I need to focus on and that we need to put in our weekly process, and let's do them really, really, really well. And the other stuff is just other stuff that, you know, it's just not a reality to get that done. And really the bang for buck is probably not there anyhow.
Yeah. And, you know, Friendy's one of the people I interviewed for the book, and, you know, he talked about and I'm sure most coaches at all levels will be able to empathize with this or have felt it. You know, he had in his head this idea that he had to speak to every player for selection.
Mm.
So like every Thursday, he'd have 45 meetings to let players know whether they were in or out. And he said, you know, I arrived home, you know, at 8 or 9 o'clock, and just like collapsed on the couch and went to sleep, and like didn't get to see my wife. I didn't get to speak to my boys back home. And so he decided to change it. He's like, during COVID, he realized how much of a better coach he was when he was a better husband and could go home and cook dinner for kids.
Mm.
And so just looked at it and said, this process doesn't work. So went to the leadership groups. Like, what do you boys need from selection? Do you actually need me to speak to you personally, or can we do it a different way? And they found a way to get him home so that he can cook dinner for his wife.
Mm.
And he had the conversations with the group to say, you know, I'm willing to work with you on what this looks like, but, you know, this, I can't get home at 9 p.m. with a throbbing headache and not be able to function in my other roles in my life, which is as a husband and as a father. And so that is just proof that it can be done if you want to do it.
Yeah.
And you know, you can enroll the players in what that process is, but ultimately that to me says he's interested in better, not more.
Yeah, no, I agree. And yeah, that actually reminds me of, you know, I had, you know, coaching fanboy moment for episode 100. I had Wayne Smith on. And one of the questions I asked him was, you know, how do you manage switching off from rugby? And he was like, you could tell he appreciated that question, because it's something that probably he doesn't get asked too much. He probably gets asked about all the X's and O's stuff and you know, how to be a great coach and those kind of things. And yeah, he talked about, he read Stephen Covey's book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And he talked about how, you know, he used to be a workaholic. It was that attitude of, no one's going to outwork me. I'm going to be the last one leaving the building. But now he's gone full circle, and he imagines, you know, his life in three buckets: himself, his family, and his work. And he schedules stuff throughout the week that's going to fill those three buckets equally, and not have one bucket really full and two buckets, you know, barely anything.
Yeah, and I mean, you can imagine the performance levels that he's capable of now through that, right? Like, this is the thing where it kind of reaches a little bit of a crescendo. That is a human being, not a coach, a human being performing or putting themselves in a position to perform at an optimum level. And so the outcome is better coaching, undoubtedly. And so, you know, I think we need to go there because we've kind of been left to our own devices as coaches for a long time, you know, through that kind of 30 years that we professionalized. And, you know, I'm not saying everyone's a professional coach, but at the amateur levels, we take our clues from or our cues from the professional levels. And so it kind of drives a lot of the same methodology through the lower levels. But yeah, we need to see ourselves as human beings who are coaching, not as coaches.
Yeah. And this all kind of goes towards, you know, the reason I reached out to you was that you put out on Twitter a really, really good thread that kind of blew up. You went viral, Cody. So good job. Yeah, it was fascinating reading. Basically, the theme of the thread was that, you know, coaches are walking away. They can't do it anymore. They can't continue to sacrifice and give more and more and more. And you clearly hit a nerve with that tweet. And yeah, it's there was some stories in there that were just heartbreaking. You know, I read the one about Tony Mowbray of Blackburn Rovers, how his son, he sees him once or twice a week, and he got the job when he was six, and he's going to be a teenager next week. And I'm like, I can't, how can you get to that stage and be at the end of that and realize you've missed, you know, most of your child's, you know, childhood. It's brutal. So yeah, what was the you know, motivation for that tweet? I'll put the link to it in the show notes so people can go through it. Yeah, what was your main motivation for that tweet? Obviously, it's themes you've been thinking about and been passionate about for a long time, but what put that together?
Yeah, so I've kind of ended up in this coach well-being space through virtue of writing the tough stuff. And so everyone sends me from all around the world, any article or video or snippet from a coach who's talking about the emotional toll. And so what I was keen to do was to put them together to show people that it's not just this isolated incident in Australia. It's not just this isolated incident in England with Tony Mowbray. It's not just this isolated incident in the US. When we look at it as a patchwork all over the world, there's just coach after coach after coach, men's sport, women's sport, and, you know, they're talking about it consistently, and they're talking about the demands of the job becoming too much, and they're walking away, and there's video of them visibly drained. And, you know, really at the end of their tether, and you can listen to their voices and you can hear the pain coming through the microphones. And I wanted people to experience that, because the reality is there are a lot walking away, and these are very talented, highly respected, highly capable individuals, you know. And one of the comments I made in there is that it's often seen as, oh, they're just not up to it then. And it's just, that's utter ridiculous Bullshit.
Yeah.
But people are deciding that they're not going to put themselves through the stressors. They're not going to put their families through the lack of stability. And so, unfortunately, what that means for us in sport is we've gone from being the bastion of leadership where everyone in the world is looking to sport as this thing that just provides leaders, and we develop leaders, and we talk about it in coaching. It's like, you know, what sort of leaders are we developing as players so that they can become better humans? Meanwhile, we are absolutely grinding our coaches, the actual leaders, into the ground to the point where they don't even want to be in the industry anymore.
Yeah.
That's unacceptable for me. I'm unwilling to accept that's what we're doing, where some of the greatest leaders in the world, in the greatest leadership industry in the world, are willing to walk away and take their leadership capabilities to other industries, to business or to the military or to consult or to politics or whatever they might do. They should be in sport. And there should be a home for them, and they should be valued, and they should be held up. And so I wanted people to see and feel and be able to react to that. And yeah, it was amazing from the professional level, the college level, the amateur level, high school especially, the reaction, you know, thousands of retweets. And it took me about 13 years to go viral, Andy, but I finally managed to do it. And
and kept the clothes on too. Good job.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that was really the catalyst, right? And to be honest with you, that was really, I probably had 25 to 30 other articles that could have gone in there, but I ran out of tweets. You can only do 25 in a thread. So that it could have been double that size, but it felt like kind of bashing people over the head with it. But I just really want people to understand that this is what we're doing to our coaches, and we should be trying to keep them in sport rather than showing them the fast way out.
It's funny, when I was reading through that tweet, I was also thinking, kind of linking to what you were saying about how early it is in terms of professionalization of sport. And I just think like the concept of a head coach, a single head coach, just seems broken. I don't think it's tenable. I don't think you can work in that model and just load everything on one human who then delegates to others below them. And you know, I'd love to see like a club of whatever sport go, you know what, we're going to do things completely differently, and we're going to have rotating head coaches. Everyone's just going to be a coach, and we're going to rotate the head coaches, especially for the away games. So, you know, we can rotate, you know, time with family, rest, recovery. They can still be doing stuff for the team at their home base while the team's traveling. And, you know, just really making a focus on, we just want really great coaches, not just one figurehead, but several coaches, a team that's going to look out for each other, and that's going to be great for them, great for the organization, and awesome for the players too.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways that we could explore, right? Like, and part of that can be in concert with the players and the level of maturity within the team and the club. And, you know, I think one of the most interesting organizations on earth at the moment are Harlequins, and some of the things that they're exploring. Yep. And you know, obviously their journey is well documented, and you know, not replacing their head coach for the run to the premiership, but then, you know, going and getting Tabs. And so they didn't overdo the no coaching thing. They actually went and found another head coach that could come in. But also looking at things like full-time open-ended contracts for their coaching staff and the stability that provides versus, you know, 1 year at a time where you can get 9 months in and not really know if you're going to be at the club the next year. And so what decisions do you think you're going to make? You're going to make short-term decisions when your contract's about to run out, or are you going to make decisions that are long-term and for the betterment of the club? You know, and so they're really exploring a lot of different avenues as to how they can get better decision-making out of their coaches. And so, you know, that's just one example, but I'd love to see more organizations break from this traditional model like you talked about and explore different things.
Yeah, totally agree. All right, yeah. And what about the individual coaches themselves? I also think ego plays a part in this, or a big part in this. It's I know from personal experience, I went through a stage where I all I wanted to do was be a professional coach, and it sounds like you were in a similar space, a while ago as well. And I think I'm really fortunate. My wife is, she's a rugby girl. She knows about the passion. She has that same passion, but she's also really good at, reading the temperature of, my work rate and what I'm doing. And she's got a good understanding of what's too much and what's not enough and what's kind of that happy medium. So I had a lot of support there in terms of like, hey, maybe you're doing a bit too much, or hey, she often says to me, you got to coach. Like, it's like you have to coach. There's no two ways about it. But I think often if you don't have those support networks, the ego can drive you into these kind of, I want to outwork everyone kind of situations. What do you think about that?
Yeah. So I presented recently at the summit for the Premier League, and we're talking about this exact conversation and what coaches can do. And yes, there certainly is an ego element to it. But I would actually point to the fact that the circumstances drive a lot of the behavior that we see. So, in soccer, like if you told me that I might have 3 months to improve the performance of the team, maybe, I would act the way that a lot of the top soccer coaches act. I would want my own people. We would not be outworked. I would be probably quite neurotic about it. And so you can look to the individuals and say they're being egotistical, or you can look to the circumstances. The reality is it's probably a combination of both. But the one that we can account for is the circumstances that we put them into. League Managers Association did a study on how long first-time managers get, and also did they get another job. And essentially, I think well over half of first-time managers don't get a second job. So that fear is immediately there that if this is my one chance, I'm going to go hell for leather. And so they do. Now, if those circumstances were different, I think the perspective would be different. If there was organizations that came to them and said, we're actually investing in you, and we almost demand of you that you put support mechanisms around yourself for you to even get this job, I think it would be a healthier environment. But they simply don't. Like they did a study on college football coaches, and there's over, I think it's $533 million in dead money. So in the NCAA, there's $500 million of money being paid to coaches to not coach that team.
Wow.
So it's the exact opposite of a supportive, well-rounded, sustained success, longevity kind of environment. And so I think we need to fix the environment around coaches, start to implement some of these support structures that we know. Like, why not reinvest some of that $533 million in a mentor, in multiple mentors around the coaches, in support mechanisms to actually develop them, rather than to just say, unless you hit this win metric, which is arbitrary, you're out the door.
Yeah, that's I couldn't agree more. And I'd be curious. I'd be curious on, in terms of people who, high profile coaches who come to an organization and actually have the emotional intelligence to say, you know what, I don't think there's enough here for me. I don't think you're going to support me in the right ways. And as a result, that's going to affect my performance, which is going to affect my longevity in this career. Do you know of any cases of that where coaches have walked away from potential opportunities because they're not confident of the support they're going to get?
Yeah, I do know of some. They're not public, but
yep.
Part of I get asked a lot of questions and help a lot of coaches prepare for job interviews. And one of the things that I push coaches to ask about is support and actually go through, with the owner or the executives, what's going to happen if things don't go well? Like, can we talk about that now before we even start? And I can tell you, most hiring panels aren't even prepared for that conversation.
No.
It becomes, well, are you going to come down and support me, or am I going to be out the door? Are you going to disappear when we lose two games in a row, or are you going to come down and show your face and be like, we're in this together? And, so a lot of administrators, quite frankly, leave a lot to be desired. And so they're not prepared to answer those questions. It's just the traditional, unless you improve our wins, then you're gone. So, like we said, coaches are leaving. But to your point there, Andy, coaches are just not going to go into those jobs anymore because they're going to get gumption and ask those questions either during the interview process or before they even get into the interview process, and they'll stop taking jobs.
Yeah, yeah. I think Ted Lasso should be mandatory viewing for all administrators.
I think so.
Yeah.
There should also be, here's my other thought on Ted Lasso, there should also be a crossover license. So if you've got a certain license within a particular sport, like he would have had to have coached college football in this fiction, I think we should look at how do we have more coaches from different sports coaching another, team invasion sport, because fundamentally they're very, 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 very similar.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I have, three kids in sport. Two girls play ringette. My son plays hockey, and my poor long suffering wife, when I watch practice sessions, with, 50 cones spread out over the ice and everything being run unopposed, I think there's a lot of room for invasion sports, using coaches from other invasion sports to help, just basic pedagogy alone, let alone any other components there.
Right.
Yeah. Cool. So what are the seven hard truths about being a head coach that you talk about in your book?
Oh, that's a good question. So the first one is everyone thinks you're an idiot.
I like it.
The second is your fiercest rival is yourself.
Yeah, yeah. You can beat yourself up a lot, especially at about 2 o'clock in the morning when you're lying in bed. Yeah.
Yep. The third is you don't possess the God particle, which is about really the art of letting go. And, a lot try to over control. And that potentially speaks to a real lack in coach education around the fact that you're running an organization, and they're not trained to run organizations. They're trained to run training sessions. And so then when you essentially put them in charge of a bunch of departments, they want to control all those departments, which is a natural reaction when you haven't told them that that's what they're going to do, or trained them, or given them any sort of job experience. The fourth is you're not a coach, and the kind of dot, dot, dot to that is you're a person that coaches, which we talked about a little bit before. The fifth is you're hired for your brain, which is really the catalyst chapter for the work that I do now around what we do is high-performance knowledge work. Coaching is knowledge work. But ours plays out, unlike in the workplace, ours plays out in the public domain. And so the ability to use your primary coaching skills, which are awareness, communication, and decision-making, your ability to use them at a really high-performing level relies on you taking care of your brain and training your brain, just like we ask our athletes to train their bodies to perform the physical work that they do. And so, yeah, I really implore us to think about ourselves as performers, as opposed to, you know, just someone who has to give and give and give so the athletes can perform. The sixth is Every Word Counts, which talks to communication and how, you know, it's so nuanced, and coaches know this, but, you know, the inflection in your voice, or the sadness in your voice, or one wrong word, or, geez, it's even emojis now, like one wrong emoji and what it can do to a player or an athlete or a staff member. And yet there's not enough thought or education or training that goes into the nuances of those communication. And then similarly, you know, they're so different, you know, being able to get a case across in the boardroom and then walk down and give a press conference and then walk down and deliver a team talk. Those are three very different types of communication that you need to master to be a head coach at the elite level. And then the last one, which is probably the one that people pick up on the most often, is I called it tactics don't really matter. And there's a little bit of a little bit of a
fired some people up.
Oh yeah. I lost a bunch of followers over that. But it's not actually a chapter about tactics, and it doesn't argue against tactics at all. And I'm a tactical coach myself, but what it means is that the connection of a group and the belonging of a group and the care that you put into the group allows you to be more tactically diverse and to execute tactics at a higher level. So we kind of have this idea that we just drill and drill and drill tactics, but the actual entry point to tactics should be connection, and the connection comes from the coach. And that allows you to implement a vast array of different tactics and techniques that you can use in the games. But we tend to start at the other end of the spectrum and think that, you know, we do good tactics and that means winning, and then winning breeds connection. I actually think it's the other way around.
Yeah, no, I agree with that for sure. And and I'll definitely put the link to the book in the show notes. And yeah, it's one I've got to get my hands on for sure. I think there's a lot of things I'd agree with, and a lot of things that would be new for me as well. So yeah, awesome. And what's new? What's the future look like for you moving forward in terms of your coach work and, you know, future books and those kind of things?
Yeah, so just exclusively working with head coaches at the moment, and a lot of organizations really thinking about this a lot more, which is great. So I do a lot of presentations, but really I'm wanting to lead the charge here on changing coaching and through the mechanism of coaching coaches. And I want that to be normalized. I want it to be available to coaches when they want it. You know, I'm at the elite level, but there's now coaches that have approached me at all levels looking to start to formalize what it looks like at the high school level in North America, what it looks like at university levels. How can coaches actually get support and not have it just be lip service?
Yeah.
And actually have someone with them. And, you know, I'm in the middle of writing a book about this at the moment to try to formalize some of that in people's minds. But the easiest example that I can give you is, you know, that in men's sport, perhaps two of the biggest figures that we look to for everything that they do, which is Pep Guardiola at Manchester City in soccer and Eddie Jones, they both have coaches that work with them, that are there for them, that help them with the emotional side, the loneliness and the camaraderie and the, you know, those down moments, the quiet moments in the hotel room where their self-doubt creeps in, or on the bus where, you know, you're a little bit anxious. They're there for them in those senses, but also, you know, in team meetings and around observing the team. So, you know, this shouldn't be as foreign as it is to people, because top coaches in the world, the ones that have websites dedicated to their every move and the ones that are constantly trending on social media, they are already the best at what they do, and they still have a coach who's making them even better than they are naturally.
Yeah.
And so I just want to point that out to people, that this isn't my kind of batshit crazy idea that I think people should do. The best are already doing it.
Yeah, that makes sense, and it's a pretty powerful point as well. All right, well, we always end the show with the same final four questions. When you were a kid growing up in Canberra, I think I'm going to like this first answer. Who was someone in sport that you liked watching play and looked up to?
Oh, mate, there was only George Gregan where we were from.
Look at that. Yes. Love it. Nice one. That is the one. There's a few correct answers from Canberra. George, any George really from Canberra would be perfect.
Smith.
Yes, absolutely. All right. And what about now? Who are some players you like watching on the field?
I went to England All Blacks the other week in London, Twickenham, and I just love watching Marcus Smith run around. I think he's fantastic, and sport needs those players that are just so electric, and like the crowd changes their tone when they're not just on the ball but near the ball. And so I love watching him play.
Yeah, no, I agree. He's a beauty. And what about, third question, what about coaches? Who's a head coach, a high profile coach that you admire, how they operate and work?
Yeah, I watch Ronan O'Gara really closely. I love the things that he talks about, around care and caring for players. And, you know, he's said things like, you know, if the players haven't learnt, it's not their fault, it's my fault.
Yeah,
and
that's
so,
true.
You know, he's obviously done a lot of work on understanding players, but also groups and what motivates them. And, obviously spending time with Razor as an assistant coach helps that development and that thought process. But then also to go and coach in another language or coach in another country in a foreign language that has a foreign language, I think is admirable as well. So, yeah, he's someone that I look to, I think, globally as someone that I really like listening to his perspectives on coaching.
Yeah, cool. All right, and final question, who's someone who's more grassroots that you think deserves a shout-out for the work they're doing?
Women. I don't have a particular one, but I just want to point out how difficult it is, all the things that we've talked about. We've kind of focused on the men's side of things. I think women do it even harder, and particularly women at the grassroots level where, they're juggling maybe a job, the primary carer for kids, and trying to coach. And so I think that deserves pointing out, and systems should be put in place around women so they're at their best as well, because I think what we're doing right now, unfortunately, is trying to turn women coaches into men coaches, whereas I'd like the natural abilities of those people to come out and almost have like a fusion of coaching, as opposed to you know, coaching must look like this, so you need to fit into this.
Yeah, yeah, awesome. All right, Cody, I really appreciate you coming on the show. You're talking about some things that need to be talked about regularly. Probably the most important topic of coaching is coaches looking after themselves in terms of their health and their well-being so that they can do a great job. So really appreciate that, and look forward to getting into your book. And, thanks for giving up your time on the show.
Thanks for having me, mate. Appreciate you reaching out. And yeah, I mean, if people want to get in touch after this, I'm very findable on social media and use it to be social as well. So please get in touch with me, through Twitter or LinkedIn. I'd love to have a chat about coaching and helping coaches.
Awesome. Cheers, mate.
Thanks for listening to the Rugby Coaches Corner podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a review via iTunes and keep listening for the next episode. You can also follow us via Twitter at RugbyCoachesCNR or via the website therugbycoachescorner.com. Until next time, keep sharing ideas to make the game better.